It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at excessive drinking in Wisconsin with a data analyst. No matter how you slice it, Wisconsin cities and counties come out on top, and that's not a good thing. First, a bipartisan group of senators released a report this week detailing security failures in the run-up to the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. Now, some lawmakers are pushing to fix those failures, but some Democrats say there are still more questions to be answered about January 6th that report didn't look at. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that issue, plus a moderate Democrat coming out against his party's voting rights bill and why bipartisan talks on infrastructure broke down yesterday, only to be replaced by other bipartisan talks on infrastructure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the breakdown in security at the U.S. Capitol ahead of January 6th? Do you want to see lawmakers come together to strengthen security at the Capitol? Do you want to see wider investigations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Turkle is Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Got a lot to talk about, Amanda, but a note from our producer here says we might get some background noise, possibly from the cicadas. What's going on?
Oh, my goodness. We have these millions of cicadas have come out centered around Washington, D.C. They come out every 17 years, and it's like, it depends on where you are, but in my yard, they are just all over. They're all over my porch, my yard, my sidewalk. They are so noisy. They're just everywhere.
And we saw one on the president, I think, yesterday.
I mean, there's one that held up the plane. I think it was the press plane going overseas. I think a cicada has been responsible for a car crash or something too. It's, they're huge. If you haven't seen them, you should Google them.
I think we're scheduled for our batch in 2023 in Wisconsin, so we'll look forward to that. All right, now to the politics stuff. CBS News talked to a group of four senators leading this investigation. I just talked about looking at January 6th. Want to give a listen to a clip of each of them talking about the security failures that surprised them the most. Here's a listen.
The intelligence failure.
How long it took the Defense Department to respond.
The Capitol Hill police were not prepared in any sense.
Sadly, it was the frontline officers who were left to defend us, to defend our staff, and to defend democracy.
Those are Senators Gary Peters, Roy Blunt, Rob Portman, and Amy Klobuchar in order there. Amanda, what are some of the findings? What are some of the big things that came out of this bipartisan Senate report?
Sure. So the main finding, which at this point probably isn't a huge surprise, but this report had some new details. It's just that Capitol Police should have been prepared and should have been ready for the attack on the Capitol. We heard immediately after the January 6th attack that they just didn't know that there was the potential for violence, which didn't seem realistic to anyone paying attention to politics. And quite frankly, anyone who was living in Washington, D.C. I mean, my child's daycare is downtown, and it was closed around that day because they anticipated that there might be some problems. So the fact that Capitol Police said that they just thought this was going to be a normal demonstration, that there wouldn't be anything, it just didn't really seem believable. And it ends up, it wasn't the full story. One notable detail in the report is that Capitol Police intelligence officers knew as early as December 21st that protesters planned to bring guns and other weapons to the demonstration. But the problem was that through miscommunication and other failures, that didn't trickle down to the frontline officers who were the ones whose lives were at risk that day.
Are there calls in Congress to change how security works aimed at preventing future intelligence and decision-making failures like that?
Well, already, obviously, the Capitol Police and these other security agencies, you know, the leaders were forced out. There are new leaders there. And yes, I think there are calls that, you know, intelligence need to be, that they need to look more at the failures and to prevent them in the future. And this report is a first step toward that. But obviously, you're hearing Democrats say that there's a lot more that needs to be answered. And that's why they are pushing for an independent bipartisan commission to investigate it further. And there are, you know, while this report looked at sort of the security aspect, the one major omission is it did not look at what role President Trump had in encouraging the protest and, you know, responding to it and what his role is. And that's what Democrats obviously want to hear more about and what Republicans don't.
Now, Democrats calling for this commission. There was some bipartisan support in the House, but ultimately a filibuster in the Senate shut down the idea of, you know, the House and Senate agreeing on an independent 9/11 style commission. For Democrats pursuing this, what are they trying to do now to get some sort of independent commission on January 6th?
I mean, honestly, there really isn't much they can do right now. If you don't have the thing they want to do is to get rid of the filibuster, but they don't have the votes even within the Democratic Party to do that. But, you know, again, this is why a lot of people are frustrated with the filibuster. This commission had bipartisan support. It was not a purely Democratic commission, and it was based on the 9/11 commission, which also had Republican support. You know, it would be the members would be chosen by both Democrats and Republicans. Democrats would get to choose the chair of the committee simply because they control Congress, but Republicans, I believe, would get to choose the vice chair. Republicans and Democrats agreed on this in the House, but Republicans don't want this because it would bring up, again, the role of President Trump, but also the role that some Republicans had in this. You know, when did they talk to Donald Trump? They could be subpoenaed. What did they know about Trump's role? When they talked to the media, were they telling the truth about what they knew about Trump's role? And so I think Republicans, you know, they simply don't want this commission to continue to drag out talk about January 6th and Trump because it is bad for Republicans heading into the midterms.
Talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up in a bit, infrastructure, as always, and voting rights bills. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Common theme on a lot of these, the filibuster. Do you think it should stay or go? Pressure on some Senate Democrats to get rid of it. Push back from enough Senate Democrats that it probably won't happen. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Amanda, yeah, I think your cicadas will try to filibuster our conversation here. I'm glad we get this firsthand perspective from them. This is cool. Moving on now, another filibusterable issue, voting rights bills in the U.S. Senate, and a key Democrat, a moderate, playing a big role, saying he doesn't support one of the big Democratic efforts. What's going on with Joe Manchin and this voting rights legislation?
Sure. So this is H.R. 1, which gives an indication, the fact that it's the number one bill Democrats put forward, of how important it is to their agenda, the For the People Act. And it's just it's basically 60 pieces of legislation, democracy reform pieces of legislation, all stuck into one. And, you know, Democrats, in order to pass it, need first of all, they need to get rid of the filibuster. But even if they did that, they would still need every single Democrat to go along with it. And Joe Manchin, he had expressed skepticism, and he came out recently in an op-ed and said, I'm not going to support it. I'd like to see something more narrow, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And his reasoning was he did not lay out any provisions that he opposes. His reason was simply Republicans don't like it and it needs to be bipartisan. And this was immensely frustrating for a lot of his Democratic colleagues, who thought that privately they might be able to convince him to change his mind. But the fact that he came out so publicly in an op-ed makes it a little bit harder.
Can you talk about this John Lewis Voting Rights Act? As you say, much more limited than this more sweeping H.R. 1. What kind of things would that do?
So the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would basically restore the provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013 that required states with a history of discrimination to clear any proposed voting changes at the state level with the federal government. So a lot of supporters of H.R. 1 say the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is great, but it's very limited. It would not address all of the state voting restrictions being put in place now. It would only address ones going forward. And so that's why they want H.R. 1, because H.R. 1 would do things like establish minimum provisions like automatic voter registration and things like that. And that would invalidate a lot of these state laws, and states would have to abide by the federal law. Again, there are also other parts of the For the People Act that don't get as much attention, but actually are perhaps even more popular and considered less partisan. things like increasing transparency for lobbying, sort of clean money provisions, you know, making campaigns rely more on small donors. These anti-corruption provisions that tend to be have bipartisan support and be very popular, those don't get as much attention. But a lot of people say Democrats should be talking about those more because those are harder for Republicans to say they're against. But, and obviously the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would not address any of that.
Is there any talk of taking H.R. 1 with all of its provisions and splitting it up, at least trying to pass some of the more popular things, or is it an all or nothing deal right now?
Well, I think there have been talks about that, but I think I don't think that's really going anywhere because most of the focus, obviously, again, is on the voting rights stuff. And so there's talk of like the voting rights stuff is so important and so, you know, it's sort of imperative right now that let's break that out and pass that. But I think you're having other people say, now, wait a minute, you're by taking out the anti-corruption stuff, you're losing any bipartisan appeal this might have. I mean, right now, you know, part of the reason Joe Manchin likes this John Lewis Voting Rights Act is he said that he thinks it can get Republican support. Mitch McConnell has since come out, said he is against it. Lisa Murkowski, a moderate Alaska senator, has said she doesn't see enough Republicans going along with it to get 60 votes. And so really, you know, I'm not sure what Joe Manchin is waiting for or what he thinks he'll get, because it's clear that Republicans aren't really interested in going along with anything in the Biden agenda and in the Democratic agenda.
We're talking to Amanda Terkel, Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post. She's with us to round up some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should there be more federal control over elections, or should things stay at the state level? Do you still have hopes for infrastructure spending? That's coming up. And filibuster, keep it or get rid of it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Amanda Terkel is with us, Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on some of the latest news in Congress, including efforts to pass voting rights law changes held back probably by the filibuster. Infrastructure, filibuster might be in the way of that. And your thoughts on the filibuster. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. John joins us now in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hi. Okay, about the filibuster, is I believe that if the Republicans take back the House in 2022, they're going to vote to get rid of the filibuster, then they can have a simple majority and stuff, you know, because I think they're more unified than the Democrats.
I think
that also in the future, it'd be nice, you know, for them to debate legislation. You know, so if somebody comes up with a bill or something like that, and then you debate the merits of the bill, and then you debate like if you're against the bill. So somebody votes, debates about the positive.
I gotcha. John, thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, I was referring to if the Republicans retake control of the Senate in 2022, John thinking that they would get rid of the filibuster. On the other hand, Republicans controlled the Senate and the White House for a while there, didn't get rid of the filibuster, except for U.S. Supreme Court justices, and Democrats had gotten rid of it for lower court justices. I don't know, Amanda, is there a thought that Republicans, if the situation's reversed again, might take a step further in getting rid of the filibuster?
They could. I don't think they would do it quite yet because they would still face Joe Biden in the White House and, you know, potentially a Democratic controlled House. And so, you know, even if they get legislation through the Senate, it doesn't seem like it will really go anywhere. So they might sort of save the filibuster elimination for a time when they can really use it. I mean, Republicans have time on their side. The way the Senate is set up, it's set up to favor those redder states and to favor Republicans. And, you know, that's why I think a lot of progressives are frustrated because they don't ever see a path for truly progressive legislation getting through the Senate, because no matter what, you're either going to have a Republican-controlled Senate or you might have one with Democrats, but they're going to be more Democrats who look like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, who are more moderate.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. You mentioned Senator Kristen Sinema. You wrote about some pressure from one of her former supporters saying, hey, maybe she should get behind getting rid of the filibuster. What did we hear?
Sure. So that is her, the former Attorney General of Arizona, who at the time was Republican, very close to John McCain, worked for John McCain. And he, I talked to him last week, and he said that he has supported her. He thinks that she could still come around, but that she and Joe Manchin need to support the filibuster, or they should get out of the Senate. So it sounds like if Sinema runs again and she still opposes getting rid of the filibuster, that Grant Woods may not support her anymore. And, you know, I'm not in Arizona. You know, Grant Woods and may not have the same pull that he once did. I think it was notable when he came out and endorsed her as a former Republican. But it does show that even people who supported Sinema or supported Manchin are getting a little bit frustrated that they're not doing what they can to sort of pass Democratic legislation, you know, while they have control of the House and the Senate and the White House.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Jefferson. Brad, hi.
I have a major concern about the security, not only the security of the Capitol, but different parts of our government that have been infiltrated by white supremacists who want to impose their theocracy upon us, who are confused about what the Constitution is. You know, we the people is all of us. It's not just, you know, white Christians.
Brad, thanks for the call. Zooming, Amanda, that in toward the January 6th investigations that Democrats are hoping for, is that one of the things they'd be hoping to investigate, the role of white supremacy possibly among protesters and especially those who went into the Capitol?
Yes, definitely. I think in the Biden administration, there is an increasing awareness that white supremacy, right-wing threats are a major source of terrorism right now, and something that the Justice Department needs to focus on. I haven't heard as much discussion about sort of white supremacists in government and sort of embedding themselves in the bureaucracy, but I do know that this is something that they're very concerned about in law enforcement. For example, we saw law enforcement officials, veterans, among the protesters on January 6th. We also saw some state legislators and candidates there. And so I think, I'm not saying that all of those people there were white supremacists, but it's something obviously that people, it's a threat that people are taking seriously.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. And Amanda, the eternal headline, bipartisan infrastructure negotiations fall apart. New bipartisan negotiations and infrastructure start up. What's the latest?
I mean, once again, it looks like for now, we're not getting an infrastructure bill. Senator Shelley Moore Capito, another Republican from West Virginia. West Virginia has had a lot of clout lately in Washington. She had been the main GOP negotiator working with the White House and with Democrats, and that those discussions have fallen apart. Basically, they couldn't agree on how to pay for it. Biden and Democrats wanted to raise corporate taxes. Republicans did not. They said, absolutely, we're not going to go there. They were focusing more on user fees and basically repurposing unspent COVID funds. They were both also very far apart in how much they wanted to spend, with the Biden administration obviously wanting to spend more. So for now, Biden has said those talks are done. He's now focusing on what's called a G20 group, 10 Senate Democrats and 10 Republicans, including Sinema and some other folks. Shelley Moore Capito will probably be part of that, but we have more negotiations, and it's not clear what the end line is or if we're actually any closer to a real infrastructure deal.
And I see on the House side, there's a group called the Problem Solvers Caucus, both parties getting together. They have their plan now. Is anybody taking that seriously so far?
you know, the problem with these more moderate plans, and we have a piece up on HuffPost today about this, is that you're now having more progressive Democrats saying, look, just because the moderates come up with a plan, don't expect us to go along with it. You know, we don't like that some of these moderates and Republicans are talking about stripping out some of the climate change provisions, for example. Whether or not progressives, and to be clear, it's so far not the really high profile progressives like Warren and Bernie. It's you know, Senator Brian Schott, Senator Martin Heinrich. But they're saying, you know, you need to be careful not to take the progressive wing of the party for granted. You know, we're here with you. We want an infrastructure deal, but we don't want to compromise too much and take out, you know, all of this of what we believe in. And so, you know, Biden right now, I think Biden and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer want to show Sinema and Manchin and the moderates that they're negotiating in good faith with Republicans. And so even if no deal comes out of it, maybe Manchin and Sinema will say, we tried, but we're going to go along now with reconciliation and passing something without the 60 votes. But, you know, the clock is ticking. Biden wants to get this done. And how long is he going to keep these negotiations up for is the question.
And in just our last minute, Amanda, what is the big story you're watching for over the next week or two?
I think, you know, the question is how much of Biden's agenda can honestly get through these days? Republicans don't seem to want to work, with Biden and pass anything in a way that Democrats are okay with. Biden has encountered, you know, sort of this roadblock in terms of Manchin and Sinema. And there are some other senators who don't want to get rid of the filibuster. And barring anything like that, you know, how can he get through infrastructure, you know, climate change? You know, there's been talk about like gun safety legislation. And so, you know, again, it's not clear where Biden's agenda goes unless he gets some of these senators to give in a bit.
Amanda, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, new data finds that Wisconsin is the only state in the country where every single county has a high percentage of excessive drinkers. An expert explains, and you can share what you see in your community over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on the morning show, to mask or not to mask. Local mask mandates are over. More businesses are dropping the rules. Are you ready to go maskless? Is there something stuck in my teeth? Now I need to know, because there's nothing to cover it if I don't wear a mask. Look at the latest mask etiquette tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin's the only state in the nation where every county shows a high percentage of excessive drinkers. That's according to new data from the Wisconsin Population Health Institute, which found that every single county in the state reported excessive drinking among 23% or more of the population. It's compared to a national average of 19%. Our next guest tracks health issues in cities around the U.S. His maps show similar trends, with Wisconsin cities showing higher rates of problem drinking than average. We're talking about the problem of binge or excessive drinking in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What have you observed about drinking culture in Wisconsin? What's your experience like? If you moved here from another part of the country or the world, were you surprised at what you saw when it came to attitudes towards alcohol here in the state? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben Spohr is the manager of metrics and analytics at City Health Dashboard, which looks at health metrics, lots of them, in cities around the U.S. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I just mentioned this county-by-county study from UW here. You go city by city. What kind of things do you find when you look at Wisconsin cities and drinking?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have 12 Wisconsin cities on the city health dashboard, and clicking along around the website in preparation to talk to you today, website is cityhealthdashboard.com. Sort of the city level rates reinforce or validate what the report you mentioned said from the, I believe you said, Population Health Center in Wisconsin? Yeah. Institute in Wisconsin, which is the city level average amongst the cities on the dashboard, which is the largest 756 cities in the country, is a little bit lower than the county average. It's around 17%. And the Wisconsin cities are around 23 to 26% of the population reporting binge drinking. So it's higher.
And for the purposes of your data dashboard, how did you define excessive drinking? What is the threshold?
Yeah, it's a great question. The data that we display on the dashboard are provided by the CDC Places Project. And the Places Project conducts a big annual survey, and that survey takes place at the county level. And they then analyze the data down to neighborhood level, also known as census tracts. So binge drinking is when individuals who respond to the survey report drinking over a certain amount of alcohol each week, or a specific incident, like one day per week where they drink a lot of drinks. And the number is a little different for men and women. I believe it's when men consume 5 or more drinks, or women consume 4 or more drinks in about 2 hours. That's considered binge drinking. So if you are playing beer pong once a week, you might qualify for this. Or if you have an exciting night at the bar celebrating something and you and your friends do shots, that might constitute a drink. You might drink those many drinks in 2 hours and constantly as having done some binge drinking.
Talking to Ben Spohr, Manager of Metrics and Analytics at City Health Dashboard, which looks at health metrics in cities across the U.S. We're looking specifically at drinking. And Wisconsin, his information on cities shows all the Wisconsin cities they look at higher than average when it comes to binge drinking. Another new county-by-county report shows all Wisconsin counties at the highest level of excessive drinking. You can join in with your thoughts on alcohol and Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. What do you see in your community? If you moved here from out of state, were you surprised at what you saw when it came to alcohol culture? The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben, I want to talk to you about the dashboard a little bit. What is your goal? I know you don't just do alcohol on there. You use lots of different health measures. What is your goal in kind of setting these things side by side so we can compare and contrast from city to city?
Yeah, so you may have to cut me off as my dissertation on this topic gains steam over here. We have over 35 metrics of health and factors that impact health and drive health outcomes for the cities on our dashboard. And the idea here is sort of twofold. Different metrics will be more relevant in different cities. Some cities may be really interested in binge drinking. Others may be interested in walkability or cardiovascular disease deaths. We also have a COVID local risk index on the dashboard, which helps you get a sort of neighborhood level understanding of what are the risks related to COVID. We also are able to put these metrics side by side and say what else is going on in neighborhoods where there is, for instance, high binge drinking. Is there also lower walkability or higher prevalence of frequent mental distress, for example? And those two things may be related. We also include a number of metrics that sort of capture the fundamental causes or social drivers of health, social conditions that we know are related to health outcomes over the course of someone's life. So, for instance, how many people in this neighborhood have a high school degree? How many of the children in this neighborhood are living in poverty? What's the income inequality like in these neighborhoods? And so we're trying to take a sort of holistic view. We also are trying to do it in a way that's accessible to policymakers, community organizations, and individuals so that you at home listening to this right now can go to cityhealthdashboard.com and explore what's going on in your city and get a comprehensive idea of the conditions that drive health, the behaviors that produce health, and health outcomes by clicking around the website. I also personally like making cool maps, and there's a lot of cool maps on the website. So we hope that you, if you do go click around, that you like it.
And you've got 12 Wisconsin cities: Milwaukee, Madison, Appleton, Eau Claire, Green Bay, Janesville, Kenosha, La Crosse, Oshkosh, Racine, Waukesha, West Allis. All of them show higher levels than average drinking. And then in the county one I mentioned earlier, all of the state's counties show higher excessive drinking levels than the national average. I don't know. Is it weird to see a whole state stand out like that? It's not. This is not a neighborhood nuanced thing going on here.
It's hard to say what's weird or not. I will say that the pattern is consistent, right? We see it at the county level. We see it at the city level. I was reading one of the reports from the Population Health Institute earlier that says the burden of binge drinking in Wisconsin is around $4 billion in cost per year. So you in one of your earlier calls asks for people to call in, said, you know, what's your experience of the drinking culture? And perhaps, I'm not an expert in this, but perhaps there's cultural factors driving this specific to Wisconsin that are different than in other places. That's not the exact type of research I do, so I'm not an expert in it, but it does stand out as a pattern.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Eau Claire. Joe, hi.
Hi. I think you just addressed part of my question. I was curious to know how unique Wisconsin is to the rest of the country in this respect, and if there were any obvious correlations between heritage or other cultural differences significant.
Joe, I gotcha. And thanks a lot for that call. And I know I've talked to guests about this topic before, and some people point toward the state's German heritage, but the experts I've talked to said Wisconsin never had a monopoly on German Americans. They moved other places too, and they brewed beer in those other places too, so that can't be the only factor. Ben, I know you've got a bunch of different metrics. I mean, do you see generally anything correlating as far as other health behaviors with high alcohol consumption levels?
So we haven't done an in-depth dive into that specific issue, but some of the metrics that I would look at if I were to do that type of analysis would be, for example, frequent mental distress, which I mentioned earlier, which, you know, that's sort of a circular relationship. Folks who are experiencing mental distress may want to drink more, and people who want to drink more, that may cause mental distress. Some of the economic factors may also drive people to drink, for instance, income inequality or poverty. But it really, and this is one point I want to emphasize about the City Health Dashboard, is that our data are only as useful as they are informed by local experience and expertise. And so I'm from California and live in New York, and I don't know enough about Eau Claire or any of the other cities on the dashboard to tell you, here's what's going on here. Here's what's driving these high binge drinking rates. And that's why I'm excited to be on a call-in show, because I'm excited to hear from others who live in these cities or other places in Wisconsin. Like, what do you think is going on? What cultural factors or traditions or what else might be going on that drives these high numbers? That's what I'm hoping to learn from callers today.
Well, there you go. There's a better call to you than I could give. We're talking to Ben Spohr, Manager of Metrics and Analytics at City Health Dashboard. We're talking about, no matter how you slice it, city by city, county by county, Wisconsin drinks more than the national average, a lot more in some cases. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you see a lot of drinking in your community? Big city, small town, all points in between. Why do you think we drink more in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll share some of your thoughts there as well. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ben Spohr about binge drinking in Wisconsin. He's the manager of metrics and analytics at City Health Dashboard, which looks at health metrics in cities across the U.S. On his dashboard, Wisconsin cities show higher levels of drinking, excessive drinking, than the rest of the country. County-by-county studies show the same thing. You can join in. He's got the data. You've got the experience. 800-642-1234. Do you see a lot of drinking where you live? Why do you think it is? What would it take to change it if you want to change it? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Kenneth is with us in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. It all is deja vu all over again. And that's in the 1960s, changed society's attitude to alcoholism and drug use to a medical problem rather than a moral problem. And through state law 5142, set up a whole system of dealing with it and prevention programs, et cetera. But all of that within the last 50 years has been taken apart by the conservative legislators, and now we have the same thing we had in the late 1960s.
Gotcha. Kenneth, thanks a lot for the call. And Ben, that makes me think, is your hope that your dashboard can be used to maybe measure progress of efforts like the ones Kenneth said we abandoned?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So this is going to be like a little crash course in survey research, and I promise I will not make this too boring. We have multiple years of data for the binge drinking metric and some other metrics on the dashboard, but the surveys on which provide the information for these metrics are not done on the same people every year. They're done on different people. And so it can give you an idea of what's going on in a place in 1 year and then the next year. But we don't advise using it to track trends because it really is asking the same question of a different group of people every year. And so it's not quite a perfect instrument for tracking change. That said, when we see patterns as strong as the one we're seeing in Wisconsin, both city and county level, it does indicate that there's something to think about and to perhaps intervene on over the, consistently here. If we saw that these binge drinking rates were high for 1 year, and then in the preceding and following year, the numbers were closer to the national average, we may think that there was a problem with how the survey was administrated or data analysis, or maybe it was a really fluky year in which perhaps there was like a global pandemic and people were feeling down. But because the CAD pattern is more consistent around binge drinking in these cities, in these counties over time, it is more suggestive than it would be if it were a aberrant 1 year bump.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kenneth. We'll go to Sue in Lake Monogamon. Sue, hi.
Hi, it's Lake Monogamon, but that's okay.
Lake Monogamon, I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me. What is your story there?
My comment would be that I feel like formerly living in Minnesota, now living in Wisconsin, I find that there are just so many little bars, township bars, county bars all over the place that don't seem to have the same restrictions or laws. So I feel like it's loose laws, if you will, that help contribute to the drinking issues because, a lot of these bars are open at times you wouldn't expect. And I don't know if it's an enforcement thing or what, specifically the laws are, but it just seems like it's so much easier to be able to find places to drink in Wisconsin. I know even one other thing, when we would come to our cabin in Wisconsin, my kids always thought it was so cool because they would say, you can drink in Wisconsin if you're with your parents. And I'd be like, well, yeah, you know, you can't. But anyway. Gotcha.
Sue, thank you so much for sharing what you're seeing there. And we heard other explanations. Pete wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page, I don't think people see it as a problem. Some are proud of it in Wisconsin's and proud of Wisconsin's reputation as a drinking state. Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Tim now in Middleton. Tim, hi.
Yes, hi. I was curious if the researcher had a breakdown of the age groups. It seemed like a lot of those cities also are college communities. Then, and if that would also skew the socioeconomics since those college students aren't don't have their degrees yet. I was wondering if they had any breakdowns on that.
Interesting, Tim. Thanks for the call. Some of those are college towns. Waukesha and West Allis, not known as college towns, though. And again, similar numbers apply in counties all over the state. But do you have things like age breakdowns on the city-by-city alcohol data, Ben?
Yeah, it's a great question. And also to Sue's previous point, yeah, we don't have those data on the dashboard currently. We do have them for some of our other metrics, but we can't get granular enough survey data on binge drinking to give a stable demographic breakdowns. However, there are other sources of data available at larger geographies. I don't know if they're available at the county, but they are available for the U.S. And it does show that younger folks, 18 to 24 and 25 to 34, are binge drinking, more of them are binge drinking than folks in the sort of 35 to 35 and up range. And I believe one of the reports from the Population Health Institute that sort of spurred this conversation said that, pointed out, sorry, that the binge drinking is higher in counties with college towns. And so I think that that's on point. There's probably research out there about the relationship between socioeconomic status and binge drinking, but I haven't seen it, so I don't want to make any claims along those lines. And finally, you know, the policy instruments that are meant to address this problem are like enforce the current laws and pass more strict laws. And so it's, you know, local enforcement is a big part of this picture.
Time for one more. We lost the caller. Is going to go. We've got Bob then in Eau Claire. Bob, hi.
Hi, everybody. Bob in Eau Claire. I was a university administrator for a good many years where we had horrendous problems with injured student and injured people. And there is a pervasive off-the-hook philosophy about the cost of alcoholic beverage sales and taxation. And multiple millions of dollars in public money is spent remediating this problem, and in law enforcement, likely 50% of law enforcement costs are alcohol related. There is an absolute need to double and double and triple again the alcohol beverage tax so it begins to sustain the costs the industry is generating. But it's so well lobbied that doesn't happen. So the attitude we've got to purvey is excessive drinking is not tolerated by way of our philosophy and because of the injury and because of our care and love for our young people and others. So it's time to go after this liquor lobby and make them pay the cost.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Ben, that brings me actually to a point I wanted to kind of wrap up with. There's a reason that excessive drinking ends up on your dashboard of health. It does come with a health cost. Just in our last half minute, can you talk about that?
Yeah, you're right. There are. It's not only an end in itself in that drinking lots of alcohol does bad things to your body, but it also can cause serious consequences for the course of people's lives, be it that they get in a car accident and die, or that they become addicted to alcohol or lose a job or other social consequences. And so it cannot be underestimated, and it could be the case that a cultural shift is needed.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Ben Spohr is manager of metrics and analytics at City Health Dashboard, which looks at health metrics in cities across the U.S. You can search for City Health Dashboard and find out where Wisconsin cities stack up. We've been talking about binge drinking in the state. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin got some better than expected budget news this week. The governor and state lawmakers are trying to figure out what to do with it. Spoiler alert, they don't agree. And a lot of people are paying off their credit cards, but some car owners are falling behind on payments. We'll get the latest news about debt during the pandemic economy. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. I went to my kids' last ever high school soccer game last night. It was a good game, competitive. I'm glad they got to have a season, even if it was shorter than usual. But one thing that didn't happen at that game, or any other game they've been in since kindergarten, an emergency parachute landing. But that did happen this month at a soccer game in Poland. A video has been making the rounds, actually two videos. One of them's at ground level. Somebody's videotaping the soccer game when suddenly a person lands in the middle of the pitch, clearly at the end of a parachute drop of some sort. The other longer video is from the skydiver's perspective, a helmet cam. I'm no expert on skydiving. Something clearly goes wrong in the air, like a glider-looking thing is deployed successfully, but the parachute, they need both of them, I don't know how this works, it goes wrong. So you can see the helmet cam looking up at the chute going wrong and down to the ground. After a bit, clearly looking for a wide open space for a safe landing in the midst of a city. What's more wide open than a soccer field? Well, not quite wide open. There was a game in progress. The skydiver and players managed to avoid a collision. The punchline on both videos, you can see the referee run up to the skydiver, and after seeing that they appeared uninjured, the ref pulls out the yellow card. For non-soccer fans, that's like throwing the flag in American football. Keep watching the skies. This is Central Time.